Welcome to this Wednesday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. A lot to get to today. In the second half, we're serving up stories of food and faith in humanity. From Fargo's 1889 kitchen, where community simmers, to a Chicago airport, where one traveler learns that even a scam can stir the soul. We begin Main Street today with news that broke this morning from Washington. House Democrats have released newly obtained emails from Jeffrey Epstein, in which the convicted sex offender alleged that President Trump, and I quote here, spent hours at my house, close quote, with one of his victims. With me to unpack a lot of this breaking news and also presidential power and accountability, we're joined by Dr. Michael Patrick Cullinane, the professor of history and the Walton Chair of Theodore Roosevelt Studies at Dickinson State University. Dr. Cullinane, welcome back to Main Street.
It's great to be back, Craig. And a momentous week. You mentioned Epstein, but there's so much to talk about, including elections.
I'll look forward to that. And I do want to begin with this morning's breaking news story. We're visiting about 10 a.m. Central. From your perspective of someone who really pays attention to this, these are significant emails, both politically and historically in my mind, but presidents have faced scandals tied to personal conduct before. What stands out here? What's important maybe about the timing? And given how President Trump is already using his executive power so aggressively during this shutdown.
Yeah, I mean, Jeffrey Epstein is the scandal that won't go away for Donald Trump. And as we've heard before, he's sometimes known as the Teflon Don. But this story is not going away, perhaps in part because he promised Republicans that he would release all the papers. And now he's suddenly curtailed the release of these papers. But this slow leak means that it's a real political pressure point for Donald Trump. And what's interesting is if you read through some of the headlines about the victims that are involved in these emails, it is the one and only Virginia Giffrey, again, who is mentioned here. And as we know, she is the person who almost single-handedly brought down Prince Andrew's time, and he's lost his title now. So, I mean, could this portend the same for Donald Trump?
And now she so unfortunately has committed suicide.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's a tragic case, obviously. She was quite explicit about her mental health in the past and how sexual assault had really damaged her mentally. And very sorry to say she took her own life a couple of years ago.
Before we move on, what would your suggestion be to all of us as this Epstein story goes forward in getting news that's accurate?
Well, I guess for presidents, the story has remained the same since the beginning of the Republic, and that is the cover-up is often worse than the crime, whether we're talking about the Teapot Dome scandal in the 1920s or Watergate in the 1970s. The more a president tries to cover up any transgression, the more likely it is that not only are they going to get caught, but they're going to look bad in the public eye, that cover-up is what will doom them rather than the crime itself. I think in terms of Donald Trump and Jeffrey Epstein, we know that they were friends. We've recently found out that Epstein was at one of his weddings and that Trump wrote birthday notes to Jeffrey Epstein. So the connection is there. We also know that at some stage around the middle of the 2000s, they had a falling out as well. So this is a very complicated relationship. And the latest emails show just how complicated, because Jeffrey Epstein refers to Trump as a dog in one of these. So there's clearly a very tense relationship between the two men.
We'll continue to follow this story with you, Dr. Cullinane, for sure. I want to move on to the federal government shutdown. The Senate, of course, has now passed a stopgap bill that will end the shutdown. Again, it's been the longest in the United States history. And during the standoff, President Trump took unusually bold steps, canceling billions of dollars in spending, cutting federal payrolls, and temporary halting food assistance programs. And that brings us to the broader question, how far can a president go on his own?
Well, if you had asked me that question a couple of days ago, I would have said, this is the end of the road for Donald Trump and the shutdown. The Republicans are going to have to give in. I mean, he had already been talking with the media saying that Republicans need to get rid of the filibuster. And they need to find a way to break the deadlock because of the pain that was being felt in the economy and amongst the general population. But what we found this week is the most interesting thing. We're going to be poring over this shutdown for years to come, because it was the Democrats that capitulated, and they gave in after sweeping victories on the East Coast. New Jersey governor went to the Democrats by a good margin. Mondami won in New York City in the mayor's race. And of course, in Virginia, the governor went to the Democrats as well by a fairly sizable margin. So why, after winning these elections, did the Democrats decide they had had enough? They were winning, surely.
What's your thoughts about that? Because I've sure wondered.
So, all right. So I'm not much of a conspiracy theorist, but here goes. I do have some really interesting thoughts about this, and I would love to get, you know, a bit of dialogue going with you here, Craig, because I know you follow politics so closely. But if you look at the Democrats that voted yes to relieve the shutdown.
And there were eight of them.
Yeah, there's eight of them. Right. Exactly. There's eight of them. And I'll tell you where they're from. So they're from New Hampshire, Nevada, the two senators from both of those states, which are kind of purple states, they both voted yes. You also have Dick Durbin, the number two Senate Democrat from Illinois, who's not running again.
None of them are running again.
Well, that's the catch, I think, Craig. None of those eight are anywhere near an election in 2026. What does that tell you? That tells you that the vulnerable Democrats, the ones that are up for election next year, are the ones that voted no. And the Democratic Party, I think, took a strategic view of this. They said they want to make healthcare the issue for 2026. The shutdown was about healthcare. They didn't get their way. And they're going to say that this is all on Trump and the Republicans. But if I was a Democrat, right, I would be upset. You know, this was a time for Democrats where they were finally gaining some ground on Trump, and they gave it all away. I would be disappointed if I was a Democrat.
The minority leader in the House has, I think, that opinion.
Yeah, well, this is the other thing, too. What this capitulation shows is just how fractured the Democratic Party is. If you look at what we would maybe say call progressive Democrats, or what Donald Trump would call the radical left in the party, they are definitely frustrated. Bernie Sanders had a scathing retort to Chuck Schumer and to Dick Durbin, saying that they've basically given up on middle America, and especially those that are suffering from the lack of healthcare subsidies. So the left of the party is saying that. The right and center of the party, though, is saying, why is the party not working? Why is it not functioning? And a lot of that responsibility, it looks like it's falling is on Chuck Schumer's head in the Senate for not holding his caucus together.
However, as we visit this morning, there have been no calls from the Democratic senators that I'm aware of for his stepping down. Does that surprise you?
I mean, who wants to take the job? I mean, you've got Schumer, who's deeply unpopular within the party, on both sides of the party's caucus. But you've got Dick Durbin, who's the number two, is leaving. He's decided he's not going to run again. So you've got this shakeup that's happening within the Democratic Party. In the Congress, you have the same thing. Although there's united support for Hakeem Jeffries, you saw that Nancy Pelosi announced that she'll be retiring in 2027. She won't be returning to the next Congress. And so filling some of these veteran Democrat posts is going to be Jerry Nadler, for example, in New York, isn't running. You just saw that one of the Kennedy scions has decided to run for Jerry Nadler's place. So it's a shakeup, I think. And perhaps what we'll see in the next Congress is a reinvigorated Democratic Party that can keep itself together in the same way the Republicans have managed to do so effectively with their own caucus.
It surprised me, and heaven knows I have no idea what's going on behind the scenes, but it seems to me, from the political history that I'm aware of, the president during this shutdown was less active in trying to help negotiate a solution. What were your thoughts about the way the president intervened, either publicly or perhaps on the side that you might be aware of that I'm not?
I'm not sure about that. I mean, I think that there certainly was a lot more dialogue before this shutdown, and the one before it as well, both of which, by the way, are the two longest shutdowns in American history. So that perhaps gives you a sense of why the president can't intervene on a regular basis to end it. But I think that Trump coming out and saying that the party should get rid of the filibuster was really a big moment. I think that scared both Democrats and Republicans into action, because the Republicans have been, you know, steadfast in saying that they would not support an end to the filibuster.
And I never saw support for that, by the way, that was legitimate.
No, not among Republican senators, actually not among some of the Democratic senators. But John Thune, of course, from South Dakota, had come out and said that this is just not an option. It's not a runner. But when you have a party that's run by Donald Trump, who has such a stranglehold over the control of the party, that could change. If the Democrats had held out for another 2-3 weeks and flights were being disrupted, who knows what would have happened?
Who wins?
Okay, the only winner in this is Donald Trump. It's amazing what the Democrats have failed to get from the shutdown. Nothing, really. When you look at what they get in the bill that the Senate is going to pass and the continuing resolution, what they get is an agency that continues to look after government budgets, right? That's always been there. That's not something new. What they get is that workers that are furloughed are going to get paid. That was always going to happen, right? I mean, I know Donald Trump had threatened that these workers mightn't get paid, but the reality is the Democrats got nothing substantial. They got an offer from John Thune for a vote in December on subsidies, healthcare subsidies. Now, that's an up
and down vote. We don't know the exact wording of what's going to be brought forward, I'll point out.
Yeah, I mean, I heard the New York Times call it a pinky promise. I think that's probably what it is. And in politics, pinky promises don't mean anything. John Thune could put this to the floor. The Republicans still have the votes in both the House and the Senate to stop that. So it's a meaningless pinky promise at best. They got nothing out of this, the Democrats.
We're enjoying our conversation, a conversation we have periodically here on Main Street with Dr. Michael Patrick Cullinane. He's a professor of history and the Walton Chair of Theodore Roosevelt Studies at Dickinson State University. I want to talk about other decisions that the president has made. One impacted us right here at Prairie Public, the rescission process, when he pulled back funds already approved by Congress for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. But of course, that is just a minor part of what happened here. Historically speaking, how far can a president go in impounding or rescinding funds? And are these actions really unprecedented? Do they echo any moments from earlier presidencies?
It's a good question. I mean, certainly this has happened before. This is not the first time. However, it really matters what kind of Congress you have, right? Because the power of the purse is in the first article of the Constitution. And as a result, the Supreme Court has never disputed the right of Congress to appropriate funds and for those funds to be spent in the means in which they were appropriated. However, if you've got a Congress that rolls over for the president, then it doesn't really matter what the president decides to do. The Congress can rewrite the appropriation bills or turn a blind eye. All it takes is for an opposition party to be in control of either the House or of the Senate to put pressure on the president. And also there are all bureaus and agencies within the federal government that can sue the executive branch, can sue the White House to make sure that they do spend the money that has been appropriated by the Congress. But again, this relies on a working bureaucracy. Donald Trump has fired so many people from, say, the Inspector General's office, or fired people from accountability offices. And also, this is what one of the things that came out in the Senate bill was that one of these accountability bureaus is going to remain in place. And the Democrats are saying this is how we have oversight over a Republican president. But in reality, what you need is the political will of Congress to be a proper check on the president by way of appropriations bills. And currently, with the Republicans in charge of the Congress, the Senate, the House, and the presidency, as well as the Supreme Court, it really is Trump's government.
Let's talk about tariffs, if we can, and the emergency powers that have been used here. Of course, I think we all recall that President Trump has declared a national emergency to impose sweeping tariffs on imports worldwide, imports that he chooses. And no president, to my knowledge, has ever used powers under the International Emergency Economic Powers Act in this way. How unusual is it? What have we learned from the Supreme Court? And where are we headed with tariffs?
So the thing that I learned is how to pronounce the acronym IEPA, which is IEPA. So this is a 1970s law that is basically designed to allow the president to take action as in his role as the chief of the economy, the head honcho of the economy. But we've never been in a position where that law has been required. And the question is are we in a position now? Because Donald Trump has announced that there's two emergencies at the moment. One is the growing number of imports of fentanyl or fentanyl-related chemicals, so a drug, we're in a drug war, effectively. And the other one is the balance between the trade imbalance between the United States and other countries in the world. And Trump has made the case that that is also an emergency. So everything that we talk about with regards to EPA has to come back to these two emergencies. You have to accept that they are an emergency, and then you have to accept that the president has the power to take steps to alleviate those emergencies. Now, you tell me, is putting a tariff on whiskey in Ireland alleviating any one of those two emergencies? It's not stopping fentanyl coming in or fentanyl products. And it's also not changing the trade imbalance between, the European Union and the United States. So there's that issue. The other side of it is that the Supreme Court has always, since the beginning of the Republic, said that the power of tariffs belong with the Congress. That is because a tariff is quite simply a tax, and taxation falls into the powers of the legislature. Now, Donald Trump has, this goes back to what I was saying about a Congress that is basically rolled over for the president. You have zero opposition in Congress right now from the Democrats on this issue. They can't get a look in with the majorities that the Republicans have. And therefore, Trump has been allowed to do this. But the Supreme Court, listening to the hearings and the sort of retorts of justices.
Fascinating case to listen to, but go ahead.
I mean, yeah, it's fascinating because I know what you're going to say. They see right through these arguments, right?
Well, quite frankly, I've been fooled before about that, but yeah, go ahead.
Well, I can't imagine. There's three conservative justices who have pretty much said in the comments during the hearing that this doesn't make sense to them from a legal standpoint. Neil Gorsuch, for example, kind of laughed out loud at one stage at the argument that the Solicitor General was making. You also have the Chief Justice John Roberts, who said that, you know, when he was asking questions, it was about who has the power of taxation. And if you look at Amy Coney Barrett, she had questions about the emergency status that Trump had outlined. So with three justices that are certainly wavering at best, and three liberal justices who are almost certainly going to reject the grounds for the use of this legislation, I don't see how this gets through judicial review. And that causes a major problem for the United States.
One of the things that on Truth Social we learned about this week is the president wanting to pay Americans $2,000 per person, perhaps with some high income limitations, because of the income we've received, the revenue the country's received from tariffs. Why that move and why now?
Well, this is like a stimmy, right? This is a stimmy check. We've seen direct provision paid to Americans by the Treasury Department before.
COVID?
Yeah, COVID. We had it when Barack Obama was president. We had it after the Great Recession of 2008. So stimulus checks, you know, that's a fairly normal thing. In states like North Dakota, Alaska, Montana, they pay stimulus to people in different ways, healthcare, but also sometimes checks via tax rebates as well. So this is not entirely unusual. However, what is unusual to me is that the tariffs were meant to be a way to reduce the deficit. They were a means to basically tax imports, right? And that, I know that tax is paid by American businesses, but ultimately there's a lot of revenue coming from these tariffs that will push down the deficit. That was the idea I thought Republicans were running with. Now Donald Trump is suggesting that this is a big stimulus package, but there is no money to play with in the budget. I mean, the Republicans are already worried about the deficit increasing exponentially. Sorry, I should say the Republicans and the Democrats, because that's probably one area that they agree on. But economists and the Federal Reserve, more importantly, are extremely worried about the balance sheet and the deficit. And if $2,000 per person goes out, and the money that the tariffs is bringing in is used to do that, where is the tax coming from? Where is America getting its revenue from?
I want to wrap up our conversation today, Dr. Colin, in the bigger picture of executive power beyond budgets and tariffs. President Trump has issued so many executive orders ranging from architecture, think ballroom, to law enforcement, in Washington, D.C. with the National Guard. When historians look at this period, make the tie between echoes of Theodore Roosevelt's stewardship presidency or FDR's emergency presidency, or is this a whole new kind of executive assertiveness, if you will, altogether?
It's an interesting comparison because I think what we have is a president who right now is very unorthodox in his media approach. But in terms of executive power, executive power has been on the rise since Theodore Roosevelt. Theodore Roosevelt changed executive power overnight with, you know, he had a restoration of the White House as well. TR created the West Wing. It didn't exist before him. And FDR had as much, I mean, we called the presidency the imperial presidency of FDR, right? And there's been other presidents that have done this too. What's interesting is that last week we saw the death of Dick Cheney, who was perhaps the greatest proponent of the unitary executive, the idea that the executive should be vested with more power than the Constitution even allows it to be. And Cheney and Trump didn't see eye to eye. Trump didn't say anything about Cheney's passing, which is, that's very unusual. But actually, what they could agree on is that the president should have more power. Now, I'm not saying that's a good idea or a bad idea, but what I am saying is that since the year 1900, the power of the president has increased, and there's only been a few checks added. And that was mainly around the years of the Vietnam War. So you need a major catastrophe to really roll back the powers of the president. And maybe one's coming, maybe it's not, but the history of it has been in one way direction.
One more quick question, if you have a moment, Dr. Cullinane. What's your take on the USS Gerald Ford being moved into the Caribbean, apparently to monitor, I don't think target is a word I would like to use yet, Venezuela, which is reportedly mentioned in connection with this development. Have you thought about that and the strength that has really been unheard of now in the Caribbean that the United States is asserting?
Craig, this is perfect because last time I was talking to you, I was trying to booster for an event that we were holding about Theodore Roosevelt and the Navy. And we had 8 commanding officers of a aircraft carrier come out to North Dakota. And what they told us about the projection of an aircraft carrier and its projection of power is that it's immense. I mean, let's put American power in scale to China. China just launched its third aircraft carrier. It is a diesel-powered aircraft carrier. It's not even comparable to American aircraft carriers. The Gerald Ford, which has just been put in the Caribbean, is the state-of-the-art technology. In fact, it's an entirely new class of aircraft carrier, the very first of its kind. They call it the Ford class. And so we've put our top-of-the-range nuclear-powered aircraft carrier out into the Caribbean, as not just a show of force, but as Teddy Roosevelt said, you know, speaking softly perhaps and carrying a big stick. The Ford, well, the USS Theodore Roosevelt has the moniker the Big Stick, but maybe we should call the Ford something else. But yeah, it's a
Bambino's bat.
The Bambino's bat, I love it. It's a major show of force, and I think it will transform the way foreign relations are conducted in the Caribbean. Venezuela and Maduro are almost certainly worried about that ship being in their backyard.
We've been speaking with my good friend, Dr. Michael Patrick Cullinane of Dickinson State University. He's an expert on presidential history and the modern American executive. And as Congress moves to end the shutdown, and as we alluded to at the top of the show, new Epstein allegations dominate the headlines. The central question remains, what are the limits of presidential power and who decides? We'll continue the conversation. I'm sure, Dr. Cullinane, thank you for helping us put these events into perspective.
Thanks again, Craig. Great to be with you again.
Still ahead on today's Main Street, stories of food and faith in humanity from Fargo's 1889 kitchen to a Chicago airport where one traveler learns that even a scam can stir the soul. That's after this news.
Support for Pray Public is provided by Health Partners, offering a simplified approach to health plans, customer service, and community partnerships in North Dakota. Learn more at healthpartners.com/Dakota Plans.
I like bagels.
Have some salad.
All I eat is pizza.
Eat some barbecue.
Applesauce and some nice red beets.
You're listening to another segment of Prairie Plates here on Main Street, here on Prairie Public. And this is Rick Yeon, your weekly host. This show is served weekly. We always have some very good and special guests in, and today is Lana Feely with the 1889 in downtown Fargo. And as a PBS affiliate on the TV side, Lana is a neighbor of mine, not where I live, but just on my block. So welcome, neighbor.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you in here, and we'll talk a little bit about the cooking classes you offer and the 1889. But first, I want to ask you about your education background.
Well, I'm a dietitian first. That was my first love. And then I got into teaching. So dietetics background, I did public health, I did clinical dietetics. Then I started teaching out in Minot, good old Minot, Central Campus. Then I stayed teaching for about 20 years before opening this business. And now I'm done in the education world and I run this cooking school.
And you put your husband to work washing dishes, I've noticed.
Yeah, damn
and
the
he's
man.
A trooper.
Yep, he is. Yep, he's our dish fairy. We call him our dish fairy. He's wonderful.
Talk a little bit about what you folks do at the 1889.
And we do a little bit of everything. We like to say we can do everything, but our goal is to get people cooking. We want people cooking in their own kitchens. So we want to really educate people. We want to entertain them, of course. We want them coming in and having a good time. They get to cook, make something new, but they don't have to clean. And then we want them to be able to replicate it at home. And other than that, we entertain. We do a lot of private events. We host a lot of celebrations, retirements, grad parties. We have a great space for that. We also do some catering. So we're kind of into just a little bit of everything over there.
And some crafting.
Yeah, we do crafting. Thanks, Rick. We do. Earlier this week, we had candle making and dried floral art. That was a private event.
It's a beautiful space. I mean, there's like marble countertops and the cooking equipment. You partner with a certain folks in town, too, mm-hmm. with the cooking equipment.
We do. Yeah. Everything that you use in our facility, you can purchase for yourself at home through Creative Kitchen. There, we don't own each other. We're just friends and we promote them. They promote us. It's just a great business relationship.
Yeah, Creative Kitchen helped us out with an event last week with Jacques Pepin, and we piped him in through YouTube over at the Annex in Moorhead. I hosted it. It was an honor to be a part of that program because Jacques Pepin is just amazing, and you can watch his cooking videos on Facebook. I've been watching them for years, cooking from home. So these education videos and classes, I think, are really important because cooking is so hands-on. You really need to learn hands-on, right?
Yeah. It's hard sometimes to just learn from a video. You can, but it's a lot of trial and error. It's helpful to have somebody right next to you telling you when to stop or what heat to use, or if you've not used stainless steel, for example. It's nice to have somebody there to assist and guide you a little bit to know how things should look.
Yeah, I mean, stainless steel pans, there's cast iron pans, there's mm-hmm. enameled pans. There's just a variety, and they all hold heat differently. I use All-Clad MasterChef and then some Le Creuset, and there's big differences between those pans, and I also have some old cast iron pans my grandma, great-grandma used, but huge differences in cooking equipment, knives, just a lot of things.
Yeah, it is. It can be overwhelming and intimidating. You can walk into Creative Kitchen and look at that wall of knives. You have no idea where to start, which they're very good at helping you. But it's just nice to have a knife in your hand and cook with it one time to know, is it worth the $200 you might spend? But it'll last the rest of your life.
Well, and knife skills are important, and a dull knife can really damage your hands. And if you're not chopping things or cutting things correctly, I mean, there's many ways to do things, but I kind of do this thing with my knuckles so I don't chop my fingertips off, which I've done when I was a kid.
Yep. Yeah.
So you do probably teach folks some of those things as well.
We do. We have a great instructor, Jen Denault. She teaches actually at South High still, but she's our knife skills expert. She's wonderful. She does a knife skills class and you go through how to hold it, your guiding hand, the different parts of the knife, how to use the tip, the middle, you know, for different cuts. So it's an excellent learning experience, and you get to make food and eat it.
Are there some classes coming up, holiday cooking classes? I saw something with lefse, krumkaka, that sort of thing. And a tour of Italy, which I think Carol's going to be teaching. She's the pro, but we can talk about that one in a little bit. Some of the stuff you're going to be teaching.
I like to focus on the gluten-free because I have celiac disease and so do my kids. So I like to stay away from gluten. If I teach a gluten class, I wear gloves because I'm super extra like that. But yes, I'll be doing some gluten-free Scandinavian things this coming season. I've got a gluten-free lefse, krumkaka, sandbakels, And then I'll do some other in December. We'll push our calendar out this week for December classes.
Well, there are a lot of gluten-free folks, vegetarian, vegan, all of those mm-hmm. are alternative eating styles. So
yeah, and we can accommodate. If people come and they're not a severe allergy, we can always accommodate in our other classes. But we like to keep our gluten-free ones specifically gluten-free for the celiacs in the room.
Now, there was a tater tot hot dish class for kids mm-hmm. earlier this week.
Yeah, no cans. Nobody gets to crack that cream of mushroom can open and dump it in. So they cooked it from scratch earlier this week. We like to have kids' classes on school out days. We have kids' summer camps where kids are coming in. It's vitally important that kids learn to cook at an early age. It'll last their whole life. We firmly believe in that. It's really great to see they kind of get a little joy out of moving up in the knives. They'll start in a little baby knife at the beginning of the week with kids camp, and the end of the week they're in a small chef knife, like a 6-inch, and they're just thrilled with their progress. They're really proud of themselves, so it's good to see.
Talk a little bit about the Tour of Italy class.
Well, Carol Braunberger is one of our other instructors. Again, another teacher. We're all family and consumer science teachers previously, so very good at educating people. And she just loves to do some really fancy stuff. So the Tour of Italy, she does homemade pasta with three different Italian sauces. And she likes to say it's the flag colors of Italy. So she'll do a pesto, a marinara, and an Alfredo. And it is just one of the best classes. People love it.
And you do classes on breads, making breads, right?
Yep. Heather Sinclair is another one of our instructors. She's our bread guru. She is great at sourdough. She could probably teach you any type of bread, but sourdough is kind of all the buzz. So she's really great at teaching sourdough. You get a starter and she walks you through the process and you get to take some fresh bread home at the end of the night.
It seems like the starter is the big deal for folks at first. So that's pretty nice.
Yeah.
Are there any favorite classes of yours to do or that you just kind of like to hang around and watch?
Oh, gosh. Well, I like to hang around and watch with my other instructors just because I learn something too. I would never like to say I don't learn from other people. So everywhere we go, we take a cooking class now. If we're traveling, we'll look for one everywhere. So we've taken quite a few. I don't know that I could pick a favorite. Maybe, I haven't done this in a while, I really like to teach cheese making. It sounds really weird, but it's really fascinating.
Well, I'm a big cheese person. I like artisan cheeses. I like mm-hmm. going down to Luna Market and getting those artisan cheeses and trying those different things because I just love cheese. Who doesn't love cheese? Well, I guess if you're dairy free, but
it's easier to make cheese at home than you think. Soft cheeses. I mean, hard cheeses, you need a system, right? But I just think it's so cool that you can make it in a day.
Yeah, I've made fresh ricotta and mm-hmm. certain things like that and those quick, easy cheeses, and that's kind of fun. But those are step one. There are other processes, you know.
Yeah, right, exactly. But it's still fascinating. People just don't realize how easy it is to make those just right at home.
Paneer, too. I love making paneer. And I put, like, cumin seeds and some chopped mm-hmm. up cilantro and the paneer. I love paneer. But, yeah, I love cheese. I profess my love for cheese.
I think you're not alone. That's why there's so many cheese markets.
Do you have any wine classes?
We do. Last weekend, we had a cheese chocolate wine. Heather Sinclair did that one again. And then we have a private event this week as well for cheese chocolate wine class. And we have these really cool chocolates that are specifically made to pair with wine from Creative Kitchen that we bring in. We've got some Swedish Christmas classes. We have Norwegian meatballs. We'll probably have some more lefse baking. We have sugar cookies will be on, the classic Christmas stuff. We also have a new instructor, Akanksha. She's going to be doing some Indian cuisine. That is, she just talks about her love of the Indian cuisine and how she brings in all the different regions of India. So she's amazing. We're thrilled to have her on board. I want to back up and ask you a question.
Sure.
You talked about your love of cooking coming from your grandparents.
Yes.
And talk about, like, one of the things we like to hear is the memories. Like, we've professed, like, you'll make a memory in our space. But what's your favorite memory from your grandparents? Like, I could see your face when you talked about it.
I think the answer is all of them. And I miss them all dearly. And I do have some very good memories cooking with my mom or just making dinners with my brother, who doesn't live here anymore, but he was a local chef in town at Littlefield's. So I just like cooking with family, I guess. And I'm going out to southwestern North Dakota over Thanksgiving to visit some family and friends. And we're going to do like a pre-Thanksgiving meal. And it'll probably be some Indian food or Thai food, just something unique. And those flavors, they don't really get out there because the restaurant scene is not as robust as it is in Fargo. But yeah, cooking with friends and family, I just think in general is important and a lot of fun.
Yeah. The memories. Those are the things you remember. That's what I remember from my grandma, too. Like the recipes, the lefse, the krumkaka, the sambuckles. When you start making it, you can hear them telling you how to do it in your head. So I just think that the memory part of it is so interesting, and that you brought that up is, it's really important.
Well, thanks for the question. Maybe we can duo on a radio segment again. That might be a lot of fun. Lana Feely, thanks for coming in. 1889 downtown Fargo, Main Avenue and Broadway. It's a really nice place. They do a lot of good stuff there. Check it out. And we'll see you next week on Prairie Plates here on Prairie Public.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Jade Presents, bringing Finnish comedian Ismo to the Fargo Theater Sunday, November 16th. Named the quote-unquote funniest person in the world in a 2014 contest by The Laugh Factory, Ismo collaborated with Merriam-Webster on an English-language comedy series. Details at jadepresents.com.
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for Travel with Rick Steves. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Are you or someone you know an easy mark? While con artists definitely have their types, anyone could fall for a good story or a ruse that gets them separated from their money, as Carol Rashinsky describes in her story at last month's version of The Tell, Fargo's live storytelling event. It really can happen to the best of us.
I'm Carol. I live in Fargo, and my son lives in Chicago. So I go to Chicago 3 times a year, probably. We have all kinds of fun. When people say, "What do you do in Chicago?" I say, "We eat and we walk." So it's a great time. But there was this one time when I was in the Chicago airport, and I was waiting kind of by the ground transportation. I was indoors at the airport. And my son was going to pick me up, but he had a meeting downtown, so it was going to be like 20, 25 minutes maybe before he got there to pick me up. So I'm sitting there happy. I'm happy to be in Chicago again. I'm excited to see my kiddo. And I'm just reading my book in a chair right by the ground transportation exit. And I start noticing this male person kind of pacing back and forth a ways from me, maybe like 8 feet from me, let's say. And I hear him say, "Oh my God, I can't believe it. They took my whole briefcase. I was at the desk checking out of the hotel. I asked the person at the desk, 'Where's the restroom?' She pointed over there. I looked over there. By the time I looked back, my briefcase was gone. Someone took it that fast. What am I gonna do?" He said, "My credit cards were in my briefcase. My plane ticket was in my briefcase. Obviously, I have my phone because I'm calling you to tell me what a day I'm having. You can overnight me maybe a credit card, a company credit card. What do you think?" "Okay. Well, I can sleep in the airport. I don't know. I can't believe this happened to me. I travel all the time. I always have all that stuff in my briefcase, and nothing goes wrong. And now this." So I'm reading, kind of eavesdropping. And then he sits down about 3 seats from me. And he looks at me and he kind of shrugs. And I say, "Ooh, bad day. Sounds like a really bad day." And he says, "Yeah, did you hear?" And I said, "Well, just sounds like, you know, someone stole your briefcase." And he said, "Yeah, they stole my briefcase. And that means I have no credit cards, I have no plane ticket, I have no ID, all I have is my phone. So I think," he says, "my company can probably overnight me a credit card to the Chicago airport. They actually have a little post office there," he said, "that they'll do that for you. But what am I going to do in the meantime? I'm going to have to sleep at the airport. This is not my dream come true. I'm like, yeah, that totally sucks. I'm sorry that happened to you. He's like, yeah, I guess it's not the worst thing. Sleeping in the Chicago airport, it's not the worst thing that ever happened to anybody. And then he kind of proceeds to talk to me about where am I from, and I say Fargo, and he says, I've never been to Fargo, but I've been to Minot. Is it kind of the same? And I'm like, yeah, pretty much the same. And then he says, you know, you wouldn't have any cash, would you? That you could just maybe give me a little cash, like for an Uber and a hotel room? I mean, it would be doing God's work, but I don't mean to impose. And I said, well, I don't know. And he said, well, I don't want to sleep in the airport. Look at me. I don't want to sleep in the airport. And he said, there's a cash machine over there if you you don't have any cash. And I said, are you scamming me? And he said, I am not scamming you. I am a good person. I'm a Christian. And I'm just asking you to do what Jesus would do because I'm in a terrible position here. And I said, are you sure you're not scamming me? And he said, no, here, I'll give you my name and my number. And then do you have a Venmo account? And I said, yeah. He said, okay, give me your phone. I'll put my name in there, and then you'll have my number. And then tomorrow, when I get the company card, I'll open a new Venmo account, and I'll Venmo you the money. And I say, are you sure you're not scamming me? No, I'm not. I would never scam you, Carol. I would never scam you. Okay, I said, here's my phone. He punches something in, he hands it back to me, and it says, Mike White, and then the phone number is attached, of course, because he texted me from his phone. See, he said, you have my number. That's the number I'll text you from when I'm ready to Venmo you, and you can give me your Venmo account. And I said, scamming me? No. I said, well, I do have some cash. I do. So I go into my wallet, and I get out $200 cash. And then I'm like, oh, $200 is going to be a motel. So I give him $300. And he says, oh, my God, you're doing God's work. Thank you so much. I'm going to have to eat, though, too. So I gave him $400 cash. And soon then I get a text from my son that says, I'm here, come out door D13. And I say, I got to go, my son's here. So I go out to the car, I get in the car, and I don't tell my son because I have this sneaky feeling that I was scammed. And the next day, we're having fun and we're going to independent bookstores, which is my other thing besides eating and walking in Chicago. So we're going to independent bookstores and having a good time, and I keep looking at my phone. And there's no one texting me. There's no Mike White showing up. Probably not his real name, I'm thinking now, but I still don't tell Adam because I think, oh, you know, he's going to think his small town mom got conned at the airport. What a cliche. So I don't tell him. 2 more days go by. No text, no message. So I was scammed. I don't tell anyone. I come home. I don't tell my partner. I don't tell my friends. I do tell my sister because I tell my sister everything. And, you know, she empathizes with me, and she's not sure she would have done the same thing, but it could happen. Then fast forward about 6 months later, that same sister and I are in the Denver airport, and it's god-awful early in the morning, like 3 a.m. Like, we had to catch the train at 2:30. And we're sitting there, and we're probably tired and crabby because it's 3 a.m. And I start looking around, and I say to her, let's look around for the person that could be conned. Let's look around for who would be a really good mark for someone like that pretend Mike White guy. So we start looking around, and we see a little old lady, and she looks kind of nervous to be traveling, but might be traveling with cash, you know. Like, maybe her. Yeah, maybe her. And then we find another guy who looks really fancy, and fancy shoes, and fancy bag, and we think, yeah, maybe him if he was really sympathetic and maybe like Jesus. So we're looking around the Denver airport for who would be a good mark. And then I say to her, okay, this is awful. Let's stop doing this. Let's think about what they all looked like on the first day of kindergarten. Some of them were frightened. Some of them were crying. Some of them were so excited like I was because I was sure I was going to learn to read that day. And I didn't, but I was really excited to go to kindergarten. But they were all one day, the first day of kindergarten, and they all were wonderful. Even probably Mike White, I said. Our minds are so wild what we can do with them. And I think I'm going to stick with this path instead of looking for who'd make a good mark.
Fall is here, hear the yell. Back to school, ring the bell. Brand new shoes, walking blues. Climb the fence, books and pens. I can tell that we are gonna be friends.
Carol Rushinsky, definitely not the Mike White type, and thank goodness for that. Her story was recorded at last month's The Tell at the 4-on-4 above Side Street in downtown Fargo. The next show is tomorrow night at 7 p.m., and this month's theme, Frenemies. You can find more information on The Tell's Facebook page or Instagram.
Fargo-Moorhead Opera presents Amal and the Night Visitors, the story of a boy, his mother, and three kings. Performances are November 21st and 22nd at 6:30 p.m. and November 23rd at 2 p.m. at the Yumcom Center. Details at fmopera.org.
This is Dakota Datebook for November 12th. The measles cropped up in North Dakota in 1905. At first, it didn't attract much attention, and there were only small mentions of it. Newspapers reported that W.S. Dow has been wrestling with the measles this week, and H.M. Blazer and family are sick with the measles. These small incidents were precursors to the main event. Contagious diseases seemed to be running rampant across the state. Early the following year, newspapers began to sound alarmed as they reported a big bunch of sick people with contagious diseases. In March, the Emmons County Record reported on numerous cases near Linton, including smallpox, scarlet fever, and measles. But measles became the primary concern as the year went on, affecting children and adults alike. On this date in 1906, the epidemic had become a significant public health crisis. The number of hospitalizations increased, as did fatalities, especially among children. It became clear that the seriousness of measles had been underestimated. The Dickinson Press noted that the mortality rate of measles was greater than that of other diseases considered more serious, like smallpox and diphtheria. With communities struggling to contain the outbreak, the state stepped in to implement measures designed to stop the spread of the disease. The State Board of Health passed a regulation allowing local officials to impose a quarantine on households affected by measles. Sick children had to be kept home and isolated, while adults not interacting with them could come and go. A sign would be posted on the door of the house, warning potential visitors of the presence of illness. While it was not a complete quarantine, those actively suffering from the disease would be isolated, and the newspaper was of the opinion that it will materially lessen the number of cases. Although widely considered a childhood disease, measles is anything but. In 1912, the federal government declared measles to be a notifiable disease, requiring all health care providers to report diagnosed cases. Through the following decade, an average 6,000 deaths from measles were reported every year. The United States Army was affected by an outbreak in 1917 that resulted in 3,000 deaths. It was estimated that 3 to 4 million Americans were infected each year. After a measles vaccine was introduced in 1963, that number dropped by 80%. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
The Bismarck Mandan Symphony Orchestra brings in the holidays with their annual concert, Holiday Memories, featuring the Central Dakota Children's Choir, on Friday and Saturday, November 21st and 22nd at the Bell Mayhus Auditorium in downtown Bismarck. Tickets are available through the Bismarck Event Center, at the door, or online at bismarckmandansymphony.org.
And that wraps up this Wednesday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are deeply grateful that you spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, we'll take a look at lung cancer. It doesn't affect only those who have used tobacco products. We look forward to seeing you again tomorrow, right here on Main Street.